You know, Luke, you could say that we really have a license to podcast.
How long did it take you to come up with that one?
I thought of it just now. Not very funny, is it? You know, when it comes to guns, gadgets, and girls, there's one name, and that's James Bond. And that's who we're going to talk about later today. By the way, this is the Michael and Us podcast. I'm Will Sloan, here as always with...
Luke Savage, Moonraker, more like Pod Maker. Am I right?
Oh, man. Yikes.
Yeah, I managed to do one that was even worse than yours. Can we top it?
I'm sure the listeners are hoping that we don't die another day, that we that we just pass away right now. So we will be talking about the brand new 007 adventure, No Time to Die, on this episode, a movie that left us both shaken and stirred, folks. But before we get to that, this is the Michael and Us podcast. We may as well talk about some stuff that's in the news. And folks, my social media feeds, which are where I got all my news these days, were dominated this week by news of Dave Chappelle's new stand-up special. Now, I've not seen it. I'm not particularly interested in seeing it.
You know what I like about this? Is the way culture works now, you can have an opinion about something like this. And in fact, you inevitably will have an opinion, or like, you will know what opinion you're supposed to have about this, even and especially if you've never seen it. And I'm not saying that because it's like, oh, people are dissing Dave Chappelle's special and they haven't seen it. I haven't seen it. I will not be watching it. I don't care. I suspect a lot of the people who are defending it from the woke libs or whatever are also people who haven't seen it, probably people who didn't like Dave Chappelle before, whatever. But, you know, as with everything these days, the Chappelle special is already something where, you know, the battle lines are drawn. And like, did you see those tweets where they would have like the audience score versus the critics score?
Yes, I did see that. That was on Rotten Tomatoes. And it was based, by the way, on the fact that 6 critics had reviewed it and 4 of them didn't like it. And then, you know, the audience score was, you know, 98% or something, because politics gets played out through the IMDb and the Rotten Tomatoes user scores.
Now, what's amazing is I saw 2 variations of that kind of tweet, just to give you an impression of how ridiculous the culture wars become, because there was a conservative incarnation of that tweet, a right-wing incarnation of it, where the point was...
The two Americas, basically. You know, you got your coastal elites who are the critics, and you got the regular folk, the people who matter, the silent majority who are voting in favor of the Dave Chappelle special.
That's right. But then you also had these tweets where it'd be like for a different movie.
I believe I've seen this. It was the Fauci documentary where the critic reviews were overwhelmingly positive and the audience score was like 1% favorable or something like that.
That's right. But the takeaway is not like, look, the voice of the people must be heard. The takeaway is like, look, the people are idiots. The 1%, the elite, the cultural gatekeepers, those are the people we should trust. The people are a braying feral mob who need to be controlled. Because they didn't like the Fauci documentary.
But to that tendency you described of the battle lines being drawn and it not actually mattering if anyone has seen the actual thing, frankly, it doesn't matter if you've actually seen the thing. It doesn't matter if you've seen the Dave Chappelle special. What matters ultimately is the cultural currents it represents, you know? What ultimately matters is what it represents, not the thing itself. Now, you may say that's a frightening postmodern take, but I happen to believe it.
I think I did interrupt your own flow of soul about the Dave Chappelle special. So by all means, continue to develop your own point about it. Have you seen it?
No. And by the way, what you said was more interesting than anything I'm going to say. This does not matter. If folks are listening to this 50 years in the future, as I'm sure they will be, and they don't know the context of what this is, Dave Chappelle has a new stand-up special, probably his 50th in like 2 years. And like the other 49, it's all about him not being able to wrap his head around transgender issues. I believe he reportedly says, "I'm on Team Turf" on the special. So a lot of people are upset about that. And I just want to comment on 2 of the reactions. I logged onto Facebook today and I was amused to see the following post by one of the sharpest, one of the most relevant comic minds at work today. I refer, of course, to Terry Gilliam. He posted, "I'm encouraging all of you to watch Dave Chappelle's new show, The Closer, on Netflix. To me, he's the greatest stand-up comedian alive today. Incredibly intelligent, socially aware, dangerously provocative, and gut-wrenchingly funny. There is a storm brewing over Netflix support for the show. I'd love to hear your opinions. I think that's funny because, look, folks, Terry Gilliam's a fucking idiot. We all understand that. Like, we've seen his movies. We know he's not a smart guy. We know he's got, like, one idea that's been very spread thin across a 60-year career.
He's periodically a great world-class artist and more often not.
You can be a great world-class artist 40 years ago and still be an idiot. And that's what this guy is. But I do love how he framed it. You know, he's from a particular generation of, I know he was born in America, but let's call him a British comedian. They come from that Mary Whitehouse, Margaret Thatcher era, whatever the British equivalent of the Moral Majority was, the Festival of Light, I think it was called. And they still think they're kind of fighting that debate. They still think they're fighting for, like, the ability to make Life of Brian 40 years ago. And they just haven't caught up with the times at all. But whenever anyone explains to them what the actual issues at stake are, they're not really able to compute it. So they always frame it in terms of this, like, you know, I would love to have a conversation about this. Isn't it great? Isn't it great that we can talk about this? Isn't it great we can have a free flow of ideas about this? Because ultimately that's what matters. What matters is, like, opening your mind. It's always some meta point rather than the thing itself. The other reaction that I thought was interesting was I found out just yesterday that there is an official Netflix Twitter account called @most, and it's verified, @most, and it's the home of Netflix's LGBTQ plus storytelling. That is the Netflix's official LGBTQ plus Twitter account for all of their programming and all of their conversations related to those issues. And Netflix was in hot water over the last week because a trans employee was suspended for publicly criticizing the Dave Chappelle special. I now see that the suspension has been lifted after quite a bit of outrage. And the @most account tweeted, "Sorry we haven't been posting. This week fucking sucks." And they said, "To be clear, as the queer and trans people who run this account, you can imagine that the last couple of weeks have been hard. We can't always control what goes on screen. What we can control is what we create here and the POV we bring to internal conversations. We have been reading all your comments and using them to continue advocating for bigger and better queer representation." And then it concludes, "Okay, you can go back to yelling at us now." This, I think, is actually amazing. I mean, So I don't want to discount the fact, I don't want to disrespect the fact that there are LGBTQ plus employees at Netflix who do feel this way and are very troubled by Netflix's support of this special. What's amazing is that this has been harnessed into the official Netflix LGBTQ corporate account.
Well, yeah, it's like the voice of management, and it's in a context of where an employee got disciplined by management for criticizing one of their decisions.
Let's say that this actually was a case of some employee at the Netflix LGBTQ arm who decided to go rogue and tweet this message that looks off script. Let's say that did happen, which it didn't, but let's say it did. Ted Sarandos, the head of Netflix, is looking at that and saying, you know what? This is good for us. We can use this as proof of the fact that even though we have this special on, we have an excellent workplace culture full of robust internal dialogue where we're constantly working through these issues. And people are allowed to disagree at Netflix. That's how great this workplace is. They're so allowed to disagree that one of our corporate accounts is able to disagree with the other corporate account. And that corporate account can require space for healing, you know? Oh. Isn't that horrifying?
it's so dystopian. And I love all that kind of language around, like, holding space and, you know, different people being valid, etc. It's a great way to avoid having to engage with the substance of, you know, of the issue at hand. It's like everyone could just walk around being valid.
Doesn't it sound like the premise of a Terry Gilliam film, in fact?
There's also something else there that I just hate, which is, like, I really wish corporate social media accounts could just stop trying to be epic. I mean, it's just, It drives me absolutely crazy. Like, when, like, McDonald's will tweet at Burger King, like, "Hey, you up?" or something like that. I just want to kill myself.
Yeah, horrifying. Horrifying. Just give me a hamburger.
Name?
Bond. James Bond. you're not dead.
Hello, Q. I've missed you.
James?
You don't know what this is.
You ever flown one of these?
Nope.
When you're ready?
You're late.
Only in theaters. Well, folks, Bond is back. 007, better than ever. Again, as I said off the top, guns, gadgets, girls. I went into this movie with a checklist in front of me with those three things and a pencil in my hand, ready to check them all off as they appeared on screen. And let me tell you, I was not disappointed. That's right, folks. We're talking about the brand new James Bond film, No Time to Die. But here's a question, Luke. Has Britain's most shagadelic super spy run out his welcome? Is James Bond still relevant in our modern world? That's okay. You don't have to answer that. One thing I'll say is I suggested doing this movie because all the Daniel Craig movies, actually all the James Bond movies in general, are interesting to me because having watched all of them in close proximity recently, I've really internalized and understood better than ever that this is a series that, aside from the first couple of movies that were really trend-setting, zeitgeist-setting movies, it's a series that has constantly been reacting to whatever the trends and the zeitgeist of the current moment are. Every Bond movie is kind of like a yearbook of where culture and popular culture was at that particular moment. Watching all the movies in close proximity has made me feel kind of zen about the series in general. When I was a younger and dumber man, I would go see a James Bond movie and it would often disappoint me and I would be frustrated. I would be like, no, they've taken the series in the wrong direction now. What are they doing? This isn't Bond. And what I've come to realize is if you don't like something in a James Bond movie, the pendulum will eventually swing. Like the next one is going to be a little bit different. And then the one three movies after that is going to be a lot different. It's just constantly adapting to whatever the moment is. You know, in 1979, James Bond goes to space because Star Wars is popular at that time. In 1989, James Bond is dark and gritty and he's fighting a Colombian drug lord because, you know, the Berlin Wall is about to fall and certain gritty American action movies are popular. But as much as the series is constantly adapting to the current moment, there are also ways in which the series is very stubbornly resistant to change. This new movie is an excellent example, as are all the Daniel Craig movies. All the Daniel Craig movies take it almost as a given that you think James Bond is irrelevant. And each of the movies is in some way trying to reassure you, yes, we've heard you, you're valid, your voice is valid, but James Bond is still relevant. However, we are going to take your demands into consideration. That's what's interesting about all these movies to me. And we'll expand on that as we continue to discuss this film. What did you think of No Time to Die?
Well, again, you know, after Many Saints of Newark, it was the second movie I'd seen in a theater in almost 2 years. So I had a great time. I went on a Friday night. I think, again, it was like the first night you could see it in North America. Had really good seats. Had a couple of drinks and just kind of switched my brain off and had a great time. I think I really am able to enjoy or have been able to enjoy the Daniel Craig Bonds in a somewhat more real way than, you know, the Pierce Brosnan ones that I grew up with. When I watch those films now, and we've watched at least one of them for this show, they're very kitschy and very silly. And obviously the Daniel Craig Bonds have all the kind of goofy Bond movie stuff. There's a lot about them that's pretty cartoony, but to me, they're just serious enough, and he's done just enough to kind of reimagine and reinvent the character that I am able to almost watch them as movies, which I really appreciate because in addition to being, more serious than the Pierce Brosnan ones or many of the ones that came before, they also still have all the cool, fun stuff. And Daniel Craig also just happens to be a lot cooler than Pierce Brosnan or the other Bonds. And he's a bodybuilder, which I respect.
I don't know. I thought Roger Moore looked pretty good for 75 or however old he was by the time his run ended.
Let's see him bench three plates.
those Pierce Brosnan movies, which are all terrible, although I do have a soft spot for Die Another Day.
Yeah. If people follow Will on Twitter, they'll see this week Will decided, you know, his latest hill to die on is that Die Another Day is actually, you know, one of the five best Bond movies.
And here is my defense of that ludicrous position. What would you rather watch on TV? Would you rather watch that movie or would you rather watch Diamonds Are Forever? Sorry, guys. Would you rather watch Thunderball? I don't think so. Have you seen Thunderball? Boring as fuck.
Yeah, chalk and cheese, Will. I would rather watch any Daniel Craig movie, any Daniel Craig Bond movie, rather than Die Another Day.
Well, I mean, we disagree. If you have Quantum of Solace in one hand, and you have a movie with an invisible car and an ice palace and Bond surfing on his windshield and John Cleese doing quips and Madonna, I'm going to choose that movie.
You know, the last time I saw Die Another Day, it was like put on at someone's birthday party. It was like a friend from university who hadn't seen in a number of years. And I went to his birthday party. You know, it was in the middle of the day. It was like an all around good time. You kind of reconnecting with lots of people I hadn't seen for a while. Probably not that long ago. Feels like, you know, 7 years ago, but that's probably just the coronavirus talking. Anyway, somebody had the idea midway through the party to put on Die Another Day to have kind of in the background. And it ended up kind of like pulling us all in, but not not for the reason that not because we thought it was good. I'm not saying this to reaffirm your point, but because we were all kind of bowled over, you know, bulldozed by the sheer kind of weirdness of it. And also just how, I don't know, anachronistic and kind of kitschy it looked. My memory of that movie, which was the last Pierce Brosnan Bond movie, was like, oh, this is the one that looks really slick and cool and the special effects really work. And no, it's incredibly corny. It looks like Moonraker or something.
I wouldn't argue that it's good exactly, although I would say that distinctions like good or bad become irrelevant when dealing with the sheer blast of fun that is Die Another Day. Sure, it's not good, but again, what would I rather watch? That or The Man with the Golden Gun? I'd rather watch Pierce. Anyway, the point I was going to make before that digression was, like, the Pierce Brosnan movies are interesting because they're the cycle of Bond movies. I hate to say it. We should retire this phrase, but at the end of history.
Oh, boo.
Know. I know.
You get more of those than I do.
I mean, in fairness, I am talking about James Bond. I am talking about the quintessential Cold War franchise. I'm allowed to say end of history in this context. So those Pierce Brosnan ones are always kind of like casting about for ways to make James Bond relevant. The first one, GoldenEye, it's like, what if the Russians came back?
Yeah, what if they were still a threat?
Yeah, the second one, Tomorrow Never Dies, it's like, okay, the Russians aren't a threat, but what if the media is a threat? And what's going on over there in Hong Kong?
It's like maybe threats will be so kind of diffuse that we'll have to partner with China, our other Cold War foe. You know, Chinese intelligence will be our new ally, you know, in the fight against what's basically Gawker.
Now, I've forgotten what happened in The World Is Not Enough, even though I saw it just a few months ago. It was bad, folks. But then Die Another Day, it's what's a new evil empire? North Korea? Can we get something going with North Korea? They seem like a pretty safe target. But also, those movies, those are true, like, Clinton-era movies. They really are end-of-history movies.
When did Die Another Day come out?
Came out in 2002. It was the last one that went into production before 9/11.
Okay. Okay, that's interesting. I was going to ask, did it come out before or after George Bush gave the Axis of Evil speech? Because something I always loved about the Axis of Evil speech was that the third country named as part of the Axis of Evil, you know, you had Iran and Iraq, then they also named North Korea. And I like that they threw in North Korea because they wanted to show that, you know, they weren't overly obsessed with the Middle East. Like, this wasn't some clash of civilizations thing. The Axis of Evil was a very real geopolitical phenomenon that they were just objectively, you know, observing. And it didn't serve any broader political objective that may or may not have been connected to global oil reserves or anything like that.
Yeah, so I think it was written or it went into production before the speech, but certainly they saw the writing on the wall. So it's an interesting kind of transition film because it still has that Clinton-era energy, that kind of like, go, go, we're the last superpower energy. It feels like a Joel Schumacher Batman movie. And it's also, I think, very importantly, a Bond movie that is before we lost faith in our institutions. It's before the Iraq War. It's before the financial collapse. It's before all these things.
Speak for yourself. At 9 years old, I was incredibly jaundiced about our institutions, let me tell you.
The Daniel Craig movies are after that. We've been to Iraq. We've seen Obama's drone program. And yeah, we're starting to wonder, why do we have James Bond? Why do we have MI6? The movies are constantly reassuring us, no, we need MI6. We live in the darkness. You need us. In fact, we are more relevant than ever. And we're so relevant that you're not even getting any fun gadgets anymore, because that's kid stuff. That's how relevant we are. You're not getting space lasers anymore. You're just getting a pen with a bomb in it. That's the best you get.
In this movie, you're getting a car that like spins around and has little machine guns that come out. You didn't think that was pretty cool?
That is cool. I liked that. But does James Bond have a rocket pack? I don't think so, because that's kid stuff. And we're not in a kid's world anymore.
Can I just ask to go back to Die Another Day one last time?
Please. I'd rather do an episode on that.
Is Die Another Day the one that it's the one that begins where he's in like the North Korean prison camp for a year? Ugh. And then he comes out and he like undoes like a year of starvation and torture just by like having a shave with his Gillette Mach 3 Turbo or whatever. And then Pierce Brosnan is just somehow rocking this like dad bod and looks very like debonair despite having spent a year in a North Korean prison camp.
One of my favorite facts about Pierce Brosnan is that he went from the lightest to the heaviest Bond during his 4-film run. That's an actual fact. And what makes that fact so funny is it's the 4th movie where he's been tortured in a North Korean prison camp for a year. And it has that wonderful scene where he's just in that Hong Kong hotel. You know, he's just been flung from the prison camp and he's like got his shirt unbuttoned and his fucking paunch is just out. That was still back. Like Pierce Brosnan was one of the last action stars who was just allowed to have kind of a normal body before, you know, the whole next generation. Like Daniel Craig had a good body and that was just 4 years later. That's how fast it happened.
Yeah, I feel differently about this because I want my action stars to be guys that lift.
We disagree. Just normal body representation on screen, please. That's what I want.
But so, Will, did you like No Time to Die?
Yeah, I thought it was okay. I like that it had a lot of the fun Bond stuff. You know, you got a big villain's hideout on an island. That's cool. You got a villain who's got like a weird face and he's got a funny accent.
I don't like the villain played by Rami Malek. I think there's not enough to this character. He's like a guy that has some facial scarring and wants to like, I don't know, run the world from his like weird Zen garden or something like that.
Yeah, it could have been better. I think his evil mastermind plot could have been better developed. His plot to, what was it, infect the whole world with this. I mean, I love that they barely bother to explain exactly what disease this is. It's like they put like microbes in your blood that makes it impossible to touch anyone.
See, this is incredible. This is what I love about this movie. I would say, you know, the Daniel Craig Bond films are marked by a lot of political and ideological ambiguity. Like they're kind of in flux. Quantum of Solace, in that movie, you know, Daniel Craig is basically saving like the Evo Morales government from big oil or something like that. Or I think that, you know, it's some corporate villain who's like trying to control water or something like that. And then I can't remember if it's in Spectre or if it's in Skyfall, where Judi Dench basically has this like moment where she epically owns like a parliamentary committee by explaining that civilian oversight of the British deep state has gotten excessive. And like MI6 needs like it needs room to operate, you know, without the bureaucrats in parliament getting involved.
Oh, I love that, too, because the villain in that movie, Javier Bardem, was like he was the result of MI6 incompetence. I can't quite remember exactly what led him to that state, but he was seeking revenge on MI6. And what Judi Dench is saying is, yes, we make mistakes. We're not perfect. Of course, the state will do things like invade Iraq under false pretenses. Of course, we'll accidentally drone strike a wedding. But we're fumbling in the dark here. We have to do this. And by the way, we live in the dark. That's why we know why this is necessary. So yes, accidents happen, but we're the best shot you got.
That speaks further to what I'm saying here about these films having a lot of kind of ideological and political ambiguity. ambiguity or perhaps just incoherence. I mean, No Time to Die, you know, has this whole plot about biological weapons, which it turns out were something that MI6 was involved in developing. And as Osito Wenevu pointed out in a really good essay he wrote for Gawker about the movie, voices are raised, brows are furrowed, and the narrative moves on. You discover that the British Secret Service was involved in developing this absolutely deadly biological weapon that this supervillain is going to use to wipe out huge parts of the world. And, you know, the supervillain, I suppose if he has a lineage in any archetype, it's with a kind of Cold War anti-communist archetype. You know, he has a really heavy-handed monologue where he seems to be somebody with utopian designs of, you know, perfecting the world or something like that. And so he's going to wipe out all the undesirables, which 30 or 40 years ago, that just would have been a sort of Cold War liberal narrative about how, like, scientific Marxism is the great evil because of its utopian designs or something like that. They're, you know, they're going to socially engineer freedom out of existence or whatever. But so, you know, this movie and you know, the Craig movies in general are all over the place. We get a really good monologue from M, played by Ralph Fiennes. It's like something out of a movie from 2005 or something, where he says, "We used to be able to get in a room with the enemy, and now they're just floating in the ether."
Who is it who says, like, it's hard to tell who the heroes and villains are? Was it Felix Leiter who says that? Like, Barbara Broccoli and Eon Productions have done the market research, and they know that people don't like shadowy government agencies anymore. They know that it's not the 60s and people don't trust these things. So they know that they have to, like, pay lip service to this stuff. They have to be like, okay, yes, MI6 created the evil, like, biological bomb that's going to destroy the world. Yes, they're not perfect, but you still need them.
And similarly, the Felix Leiter character, who I quite liked, actually, I think he's a really good character and very solidly played. His whole thing is that he's, like, you know, like Bond, who's retired from MI6, he's an ex-CIA guy. And he's pissed off with the bureaucrats, but in his case, they're the bureaucrats over at CIA. And so this speaks to how weird and ambiguous these films are politically, because it's kind of like, oh yeah, the CIA is bad here. They're, you know, they're the malefactor. Same with MI6. But also the protagonists are just, like, rogue agents from those very agencies or whatever, who are operating, you know, with even less oversight. Speaks to the ambiguity of these films. It also speaks to the fact that they are, above all else, commercial productions. So they have to be kind of as broad as possible. And the broadness produces a lot of amusing incoherence.
Isn't it funny that Daniel Craig, I think, spent just as much time as a rogue agent in these movies as he spent as a real agent, as a licensed agent? He's constantly going rogue. And in fact, you know, the series started with him in Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace, just sort of, like, becoming an agent and then going rogue and then becoming an agent. And then all of a sudden, we've had a series of movies where he's retiring one after another. What we haven't seen are just him as Roger Moore. We haven't seen him just going on regular missions as Her Majesty's Secret Servant. I think it's very telling that they haven't had him just be a regular agent, really. There's something in the market research that's telling them audiences don't want that right now. Audiences are distrustful of these shadowy, paralegal government agencies. But, like, he's always going rogue essentially to uphold the agency itself. He's going rogue to save the agency from itself.
None of this is to say that I didn't enjoy the movie, because I did have a lot of fun watching it. I do think Daniel Craig is very compelling as this character. I really like watching him on screen.
He's fantastic. He's the best Bond. I mean, he hits all the notes. He's funny. He's suave. He can fight. He can act, which not all of them could do.
He's also plausibly kind of fucked up and cynical about everything, which I like too.
He has a powerful weapon. He charges. The man with the golden gun.
I quite liked a few sequences in this movie. I really liked the kind of prequel sequence, which I guess is right at the beginning.
Oh, the big action scene with the motorcycle. Very exciting.
No, I mean, I did enjoy that, but that's not the one I mean. I mean the one where you see young Madeline Swan, played by Lea Seydoux, when she's a child, and a mysterious figure comes and murders her mother. that's the kind of sequence that I feel like you wouldn't get in a Pierce Brosnan Bond. And it's the kind of thing that helps these movies feel just a notch more serious than those other ones.
I agree with you, although I do miss a little bit of the levity of some of those earlier movies. I did like some of the jokes, although maybe I didn't now that I think of it. Maybe I'm always just looking back at whatever the last one was going like, oh, that was the real Bond.
I feel like your love of something like Die Another Day is tangled up in so many layers of irony that you no yeah. longer know what you think. And at least with the Daniel Craig movies, you kind of know where you stand.
I am going to say that this is, by most objective standards, a better movie than Die Another Day. but again, which one would I rather watch? The other thing I want to talk about in this movie is the introduction of a new Agent 007. So as the film begins, I'm not going to bother with a complete plot synopsis for this one. It's a James Bond movie, folks. The film begins with Bond retired, and he spends 5 years in retirement, most of it in seclusion. And during his retirement, a new agent has replaced him as Agent 007. She's played by Lashana Lynch, who is a black woman. This is another example of Eon Productions, you know, they've heard you, you are valid, your feelings are valid, they've seen what you've been posting on Twitter, they know that you think that if James Bond has to exist, he should be played by somebody who is not a straight white male. Here, in a mighty blow to the patriarchy, is a black woman assuming the number of Agent 007. And so there is a lot of tension, a lot of comic tension in the film, you know, as James Bond kind of gets back into the spy game. There is a rivalry between him and her over sort of who is the rightful claimant of that iconic number, 007. Within the diegesis of this film, 007 is a number comparable to like Wayne Gretzky's number 99, you know? One of those numbers that the jersey gets retired after the agent has retired, but except not in this case because she's taken it on. So the production company knows that you've spent many years saying enough with these straight white men as James Bond. We need diversity in this series, if nothing else. So throughout the movie, you have this tension between these characters, and you find out as it goes along, you know, these characters have a lot to learn from each other. James Bond, he's a bit of a dinosaur. He has a lot to learn from this young, very competent woman. But you know what? She's a little young. She's a little inexperienced. She has a lot to learn from this dinosaur, James Bond.
Yeah, it's sort of similar to the take on like intelligence agencies and who's ultimately responsible for geopolitical evils. The film very much tries to have it both ways with this, doesn't it?
The exquisite scene in this movie is before the climax, when essentially
yes.
a partnership has been established between both 007s, past and present 007. They are on a Zoom call with M, just as they're about to invade Rami Malek's lair. And Lashana Lynch says, by the way, sir, permission to restore the 007 number to James Bond. And he says, permission granted. So finally, you know, after this rivalry, she finally accepts her junior partner status. James Bond is ultimately 007. She acknowledges this. Nobody does it better than James Bond. And folks, don't you forget that, okay? James Bond is relevant. James Bond is more relevant than he's ever been. And you can have your fun. You know, you smashed the patriarchy with this little flirtation with a black woman 007. But ultimately, this is what the franchise is, and you better understand that.
But then having done that, I mean, you say that, Will, but then having done that, there's also the way the film ends, which, spoiler, if you want to watch it, you should pause now before continuing. But it's impossible to talk about this movie without talking about the fact that they literally kill James Bond at the end of the movie. So granting what you just said, the film is also saying at the end, well, actually, it is time to retire James Bond. James Bond is monogamous in this movie. It turns out he's a family man. And it's for that reason that he decides that he's going to stay on the island as, you know, the missiles are coming in, improbably launched from British warships in the Pacific Ocean to destroy this island and the biological weapons facility it has on it. Bond stays behind because he finds out that he's been infected with something that will specifically target Madeleine Swann, the character played by Lea Seydoux, and her daughter, who he finds out is also his daughter. So the film is saying James Bond's irrelevant. Actually, he's not. Actually, he is. Actually, I'm not really sure what it's saying.
You know what it's saying? It's saying James Bond will return in the guise of a younger, cheaper actor very soon. you're right. It does end on an ambiguous note that leaves James Bond's relevancy kind of uncertain. I do want to just say, though, to that point about how James Bond is a monogamist in this movie, that is interesting. It shows that there are certain ways that this franchise actually will change, and there are certain ways that it definitively will not change. The franchise will never say that MI6 shouldn't exist, but it will get rid of the overt sexism. James Bond is not as sexist as he was in the 60s. They're willing to cede that. So, folks, you've won that war, but there are other wars that you're not going to win.
Well, there's the whole sequence in this film with Ana de Armas in Cuba, where, you know, initially Ana de Armas, you know, this is something the Bond movies have done before. Initially, Ana de Armas seems like she's totally out of her depth. She's incompetent. And then, you know, 15 minutes later, you know, she's like beating the shit out of bad guys, you know, in her high heels and like sniping enemies on the balcony and stuff like that. But unlike in previous Bond films, at the end of it, James Bond just says, well, you know, you're very competent. Hope we get to work together again.
And in fact, there's a scene where she brings him into a closet and she asks him to undress. And he's like, shouldn't we get to know each other first? And she's like, no, you're going to change your suit. The implication being he's too old for her. He's not Sean Connery anymore. He can't just have literally every woman he wants, literally anytime he wants. Anyway, clearly James Bond in 2021, a land of contradictions. I am excited to see how this franchise develops in the future.
Well, I liked what Ozita said about this in his piece. He wrote, "The last 50 years of Bond have been a difficult balancing act. With Craig in the role, the franchise has worked harder than perhaps any other to satisfy both film snobs and a rabid fandom. The fact that his films retained their reputation as serious relative to their predecessors, even as they began borrowing more liberally from them, is a testament to the success of the Bond team's efforts. In truth, most of the difference between Pussy Galore and Madeleine Swann resides in the kind and not the amount of nonsense the series offers its viewers. But the films wouldn't be themselves if they dispensed with the nonsense altogether. And while there's no harm in imagining new things they could attempt within the constraints of the Bond formula, we shouldn't delude ourselves into believing that there is a kind of Bond film that we quote-unquote need right now, or that the reinvention of pop heroes brings us much closer to solving our real-world problems. That said, I'll be awaiting 007's return with great interest, less out of any hope or expectation that the series will do right by my politics and preferences than out of sheer curiosity. How much longer can they keep this thing going? How's Bond going to save his hide this time?"
My dear girl, there are some things that just aren't done, such as drinking Dom Perignon 53 above a temperature of 38 degrees Fahrenheit. That's as bad as listening to the Beatles without earmuffs.
When Daniel Craig was announced as James Bond, I think he was announced in 2005. Casino Royale came out in 2006. It's been kind of half forgotten, but he was actually a controversial choice at the time. And the reasons that he was controversial were that he was blonde. There had never been a blonde James Bond before. And some thought that he was not good looking enough. You know, he didn't have a face like Pierce Brosnan's. There was this amazing sight, like, back in 2005, the internet was a small enough place that if you just had a website, just the existence of a website could go viral. There was a site called DanielCraigIsNotBond.com that was this obsessive blog chronicling how they were destroying this franchise. How could you make this man James Bond? How could you kick Pierce Brosnan to the curb? And I checked today, and that blog is still up. It's still been going. Like, they are still
it's been
waging
going like
this,
as long as the war on terror.
Like, they are like those Japanese soldiers who didn't realize the war is over. And I'm kind of sad for them because, I mean, if you can't appreciate, if you're a James Bond fan and you can't appreciate Casino Royale, I mean, there's no hope for you. You're just depriving yourself of fun. Come on. Anyway, they have been posting obsessively. I recommend people check this out. DanielCraigIsNotBond.com. And they've been posting obsessively about their opposition to this new Bond film. And there's one post, I haven't read the whole thing. There's one post called Redefining. And the opening lines are, "Good news, we finally destroyed toxic masculinity by ascribing all those same attributes to a female character. So, you know, you can imagine how it goes. Like, I like how this blog has evolved with the times in a way. It's just become a reactionary culture blog.
But I find that take very confusing, actually. You say, well, you can imagine what comes next. I can't, actually, because, you know, it sounds like it's, you know, the kind of reactionary critique of like, oh, well, there's a black female James Bond. They're destroying James Bond, who's the quintessential, you know, white male hero. And, you know, they're destroying our society because of it. It sounds like they're making that point. But then there's that thing about toxic masculinity, where it sounds like they're actually saying that toxic masculinity has just been kind of transubstantiated to the black female 007. So I don't know what to believe.
I'm just reading over the post now, and essentially the thrust of the argument is, hey, look, we've had strong women all through the series. What about Michelle Yeoh, guys? What about Michelle Yeoh? Hasn't this series done enough for you? Folks, I guess you could say that the politics of the Daniel Craig is not Bond.com blog are just as incoherent as the series. It really is a fitting tribute.